Works Advisory Board for the City of Morro Bay. Let it be known that all members are present and accounted for, and we'd like to start this evening with a moment. Concerns about the agenda, we are a short agenda this evening. Everyone okay with that? Needs to be covered and dealt with immediately. Mr. Boucher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an announcement about a problem with the drinking water. I don't want to underestimate the magnitude of this. We, as a result of chemical analyses received today, we found that the nitrate levels in the drinking water are 48 milligrams per liter. This exceeds the state and federal standard for nitrates of 45 milligrams per liter. There's three things I would like to do. First, I would like to provide a more detailed warning to let you know some of the ramifications, and then to inform you of what we are actively doing now to mitigate the situation. Water with the high nitrates should not be given to, and if untreated, may die because high nitrate levels can interfere with the capacity of the infant's blood to carry oxygen. Symptoms include shortness of breath and blueness of the skin. Symptoms in infants can develop rapidly, with health deteriorating over a period of days. If symptoms occur, seek medical attention immediately. It used to be called blue baby syndrome, but this is it's a very serious issue. High nitrate levels in pregnant women may also affect the oxygen-carrying ability of the mother's blood. Water, juice, and formula for children under 6 months of age should not be prepared with tap water. Bottled water or other water low in nitrates should be used for infants until further notice. Do not boil the water. Boiling, freezing, filtering, or letting water stand does not reduce the level of nitrates in the water. As a matter of fact, boiling the water can result in an increase in the concentration of the nitrates. If you have other health issues concerning the consumptions of water, such as dialysis, you may wish to consult your doctor. Nitrates come from natural sources, generally fertilizers in the ground. For those of you aware, we are in the state water shutdown right now. We are using our local groundwater. We are down gradient from many agricultural lands, and our groundwater is susceptible to nitrates. We have been monitoring the nitrates. The last time we took our samples was at the end of last week. The level was 20 that had the highest concentrations of nitrates, and we switched to other wells that have lower nitrate levels. We will be taking samples throughout the potable water system starting tomorrow morning to test the effectiveness of this mitigation. We fully anticipate that this situation will be remedied soon. If switching to these alternate wells do not work, I've contacted the operators of our desalting plant, and if this situation does not clear up by tomorrow, we will have the desalter up and operating by Friday. And the desalter, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a non-selective filter. It will take out virtually all the nitrates, and if full potability is not restored tomorrow, it will be restored on Friday. I don't want to panic the board and the public, but this is a serious matter. We're not trying to dodge anything here. The citizens need to know the importance of it. For the average person, the situation is a more chronic, not an acute thing, but for babies, for pregnant women, and for individuals with special health concerns, it can be an acute problem. We will be providing additional notification because this notice may or may not reach every home in town.
And we're not live tonight, so
unfortunately, we're not live. So we will be preparing additional public notifications. I just found out about an hour ago. So
can we, while we're on that, can we make sure that we get those in Spanish as well? We have a large Spanish population in the city. Thank
you. There's a protocol.
48 is out of the tap then.
That is correct.
Mixed. So the maximum exposure would have been from the, it's a weekly test that's done.
We had been doing it weekly. Now we're going to go to twice a day.
And the just in terms of the outreach, I mean, I don't know if there's any possibility of just an announcement made with the city council saying, watch, there's a public service announcement on Channel 20 or something like that. And you just found out an hour ago, and so you may not. Well, they probably have emergency call. I'm just thinking of involving, especially for some of the harder to reach or the populations that may not readily have the funds or resources, the public health department would be the contact, especially public health, nursing, and the community care centers, because that's where basically a group is getting its prenatal and postnatal and infant care.
There are specific noticing procedures
I should have asked it that way, I'm sure, because you're on top of it.
The schools, the daycare centers,
so
public health facilities,
what information
the convalescent hospital, there are a number that we will be providing a particular effort to, mm-hmm. to make sure they're notified in a timely manner.
First of all, I applaud staff for their quick response,
mm-hmm.
and phenomenal, very good. I have another question, if I may, please. Does this affect the water machines that you can get? You know, you buy water for a quarter and the machines are
be fine. And I should point out, and I don't mean to minimize it, but the average person is not exposed nearly to the degree of infants, pregnant women, and those with special medical conditions.
Okay.
But I don't mean to minimize and gloss over it by any means.
Thank you. And again, high kudos.
And just to give you a little bit of a background of what we were doing, because we switched to other wells. So the obvious question is, why didn't we use those wells in the first place? As you recall, the Moro Valley wells adjacent to Kaiser Park had the MTBE contamination. So during the state water shutdown, we took the opportunity to run those wells to try to determine whether the operation of those wells was drawing the MTBE plume towards the wells, which has been one of our critical concerns. What happened was we had done our pre-monitoring and monitoring during, and the nitrate levels, as I said earlier, were in the medium range. But this spike here, it's totally unexpected. But fortunately, we do have contingencies, as I said, switching to the alternate wells. And if the alternate wells do not work, then we will activate the desalting plant, which we know will take care of everything.
Bruce, how often does the state do a shutdown similar to this?
Every November for 2 weeks.
So is there any ideas about potentially contacting farms up the
to the state water purveyors today, just this morning, saying, why do you do this shutdown in November, which is our worst time of the year, when the water quality and quantity of our groundwater resources is at the worst? Versus in February or March, when our demand is low, the weather is cool, no irrigation, and the water quality, our groundwater quality, is the best. And I shouldn't have done that, because maybe some karma thing, or is it dharma if you're alive? I don't know. I don't mean to be flippant about it, but it was just so coincidental. And so I notified them, and hopefully that'll open the dialogue on switching this shutdown to something that's more advantageous to our citizenry.
Just a question. In the future, will you be checking more frequently, since this only checked last week and then checked this week, and that's how it managed to spike? Would you in the future, like next year and the year after, be checking more frequently?
Starting tomorrow, we're doing twice a day.
Right. But I mean,
on all the sources.
When this happens next year, because this happens every year.
This is the first time we've seen where there's been such a dramatic increase in such a short time. A doubling of the nitrate levels in a period of the samples were, I think, 5 days apart. 5 days is a fairly narrow. We had talked to the health department about the testing protocols because these wells have historically been susceptible to nitrate contamination. So when we were working out the operational scenarios for the state water shutdown, we were working with state health to make sure that they were comfortable with our sampling and testing and reporting protocols. So we thought
for a tertiary treatment plant and plan to help us, you know, avoid needing to draw off of these wells during this time of the year and so on.
I'm not aware that a tertiary plant would have any effect on that.
And that's one's wastewater and one's water. One's input drawn out of the groundwater, and one's the wastewater coming out of the treatment plant.
For the Chora, I'm talking specifically the idea of a Chora Creek treatment plant.
Well, if we are in a position where we are discharging cool, clear, appropriately treated wastewater into the Chora Valley, and we are allowed the unfettered use of our Chora wells during this time, then our water quality would be superior. I think there's no question about that.
But that wouldn't change the Morro Basin water.
That doesn't change the Morro Basin wells. And unfortunately, we were trying to, well, not unfortunately, but what we decided to do for one last time, because, and Frank will get into this in more detail, the Shell Equilon people want to get closure on the MTBE issue. And we wanted to do one more intensive test before we as a staff could make a recommendation of whether we thought it was or was not appropriate to have that closure. And clearly, I mean, we've stopped operating the wells, so that idea is moot. I mean, we'll have to deal with that, but that's certainly not a critical factor.
Vicki, I'll off before they really get into what I'd call hardcore best management practices, but there is something. The other thing I wanted to throw out, I don't believe those charcoal Brita systems remove nitrates. So don't be fooled by, you know, I mean, RO versus these little charcoal filter systems. So be careful that you think you're running it through a little filter system that you're not.
Just to back up on what you were just saying a moment ago about the state and the ag, would it behoove our city staff to talk to our local farmers rather than waiting for a few years for an action to take place? Would it help this particular situation in the future to talk to our local farmers and see if we can't somehow convince them the errors of their ways in using fertilizers that put a large amount of nitrates into our system? Is that something that we can do?
That's possible. That's possible. I don't mean to again be flippant, but the effectiveness of city, you know, city people going to tell a farmer what's an appropriate way to run their many generation family business might not be in it.
What I'm maybe suggesting is letting them know of the problem that has arisen and how together, working together, we might resolve it from happening again. And is there an action that needs to take place to encourage staff to do that, or can staff do that on their own, or what's the procedure?
Let me throw this thought process on her, because, you know, groundwater is a very slow-moving, glacier-speed aspect, so better now than they were 10 or 15 years ago, and they're all preparing to move into that new generation of a little regional water quality control board regulation. So I think it's coming. It's just, you know, we got these plugs coming down from, you know, heavy ag operations that came through who knows when. So, you know, as I think Bill said, you know, the city can pound doors and make statements and try to put pressure on them, but I think the ag community is kind of heading in that direction anyway.
Thank you for the clarification. Appreciate it.
I just wanted to ask about the pattern. Pardon? Is it okay now?
The light's on.
I just wanted to ask about the pattern of testing in that, with the idea that we don't know that it was insufficient, and I'll say I have a public health background, so often something comes up, and a policy is then established in response to that one item when it really isn't necessary, and I'm not trying to minimize what's been detected. Will continue to test the wells that have been shut that you think are the high ones so you can get the pattern? In other words, are we seeing just an aberrant spike, something happened, or we're in a phase where now that it's gone up, it's being sustained for quite a while? Because the pattern of testing in the different wells now is what you look at to see what will be a reasonable one for the future. Just because they were 5 days apart doesn't mean 5 days won't be fine. It depends on the pattern.
Well, what we had seen and saw that there was a gradual increase. So we did expect a gradual increase.
It fits with what Frank was pointing out.
You know, the
so spike, we may have to live with it for a while. Yeah,
the spike that we saw was completely, well, I mean, if it was expected, it wouldn't have happened. It was completely unexpected. We do, and just again, just to summarize, we do fully expect that this first mitigation of operating the wells with lower nitrates will be completely effective. In the event that it is not, for whatever reason, we will have the desalter operable before the end of this week. That will take care of the problem. And on the outside, we have the level of comfort that once state water comes back online on Monday, acknowledging that it takes a day or so for the water to work its way through the entirety of the system, that water will have significantly lower nitrate levels. So kind of have three contingencies, but that doesn't help for today.
So any other questions for Bill on this specific topic? So just to clarify, with NOAA, I think anybody who's concerned with environmental issues, I think it's been known for decades that chemical nitrates are harmful to the environment and people who use the environment, which is all of us, and supporting organic farmers, and push for education in the community to try to educate people that we need to change our practices over time in a lot of ways. And also, I want to say that this meeting is not live. It is taped. It is Wednesday, November 15th. So if you're hearing this, it'll
return to completely potable tomorrow.
Okay. So that would be the...
In the event, that would be Thursday. Thursday the 16th.
Okay.
In the event that, for whatever unforeseen reason, it does not, then the desalter will be operable on Friday, and it will return to potable on Friday.
Okay.
How will the public know when it does return to a safe level?
We're going to have to... do additional public contacts.
And yeah. They can call to check the status of public services, 772-6261.
That's correct.
Is that our number?
And that's what I was asking about the health department. People will often call the health department. They're part of this established network.
Absolutely.
Right.
And the more critical is getting the word out if it isn't returning. But it, again, as I say, 20 years in public health, excellent, no spin response, just the facts. Community well served.
And also for folks, just to recap, children, infants under the age of six months old, pregnant women, do not use tap water in the interim. Do not boil it. Do not freeze it. Do not use your home filters unless you have a reverse osmosis system. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Reverse osmosis systems, if I said that right, should be safe. And don't trust your little tap filters. Use bottled water. The water coming out of the pay machine should be safe. They use reverse osmosis. And please check if you're uncertain. If you're getting this message later, as we're recorded and replayed and reruns, you're getting it later in the month, please be advised.
Okay. If I can ask, how does that notice take place? And this is just
That's me going there.
It's better than snail mail.
To the physicians locally, the medical society doesn't.
No, this is bill mail.
Okay.
Do you need, if you need volunteer help for that, do you have anybody you can call on to help?
Well, we have staff,
okay.
I think it's important, as Dr. Dorfman kind of alluded, it's important that the information that goes to the doctor, that there's someone there that can be conversant with the doctor on the operations of the system, so that the doctors are fully aware of the situation and what steps and what mitigations are being performed.
Very good. Okay, thank you very much, Bill, for bringing that. We don't like hearing this kind of news, but we do like knowing that you guys are looking out for us, so we appreciate it. And also, this is citywide because of our interlining of our water sources.
Yes,
correct?
This is all the customers in the city, yes.
Okay, thank you. Any last-minute closer on this one particular item? Okay. Let's see. Were there any other announcements, since that is where we are? No takers? Okay. Written comments. We have a letter from the bike committee. And that is the only one that we have here. Since I didn't have time to enlarge that, if anybody would like to read that, I would certainly entertain that. If not, bike committee, please accept my apologies for not having that magnified enough for me to read. And let's move on to public comment. We have one member in the audience. Would you like? As far as what? I didn't hear what you said.
Municipal Wi-Fi.
Is that on the agenda?
You've got a report, a summary that's going to supposedly be given on this bill 2987.
Yes, that's relating to cable franchising for video service.
Yeah, but that would affect this, because this bill is. As I understand it, meant to circumvent cities putting in their own municipal system, which is something that I'm very much in favor of, and the people that own the cable companies are not in favor of. A lot of communities have done it, and I've brought some articles, you know, explaining it.
Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of the municipal Wi-Fi aspect being part of the AB 27.
Maybe it's not.
But there may be another bill.
This was the bill I was referred to.
Okay.
There was also a bill in Washington that didn't make it. So, you know, there may be some room for hope on a system like this. Anyway, I'm a proponent of looking into a Wi-Fi system for many reasons, not the least of which for the city itself, the information that we just received would have been able to be broadcast to all the pertinent agencies in town. There is, I understand, money as far as getting grants to start something like this available from Homeland Security, because all your emergency, your fire, your police, your city hall, all your responders would be a perfect comparison. Is that the cities that don't have this are like the cities that the railroad went by in the 1800s. And the articles that I'm going to leave with you, this one to me is the most pertinent because it explains how the rest of the world, Japan particularly, are taking advantage. And what we pay broadband here is about half as fast as they use over there as their everyday. You know, we are really falling behind in this area. So it's something that I would like the city to look into and entertain the possibility. I think everybody would benefit. It evens out even your economic classes for access to information and the world out there. So that's what I had to say. And I'm going to stay and listen and see what Jeanine's report. May I leave this with somebody?
Don't run away yet.
Yes, please.
Oh, okay.
You're a member of,
keep in mind that we can, in public comment, we can't discuss what the public comment is.
I don't see a reason why we can't. I mean, there's nobody here but us.
Would a staff member like to?
I just want to ask a question, if I may. May I ask her a question? Are you a member of the? You're a member of the promotions committee, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Have you made a presentation to the promotions committee involving Wi-Fi? Because I think tourism would greatly benefit.
Well, yes, obviously it would.
Yes.
I'm on their webpage.
Applaud you and your efforts, and I think it's something that Morro Bay should definitely get behind and pursue.
Well, there's so many benefits. I understand you can even read the water meters through this system. You know, I don't know, maybe you could monitor the wells through the system. There's a lot of layers to it, obviously.
Is there a technical person that could join you in a presentation to the council?
I could certainly look for one.
Because I would recommend that you maybe do that.
Roger, excuse me, please. Pursuant to the Brown Act, we cannot discuss the public. Look at your agenda. Look at your agenda under public comment.
Anyway, you got the
message.
Right.
I would ask the discussion for that reason be halted. I'm not prepared to discuss this nor say how I feel
it's
about it.
It's not supportive, yeah. Non-supportive.
I'm not asking
not
for it. I just was trying to get
fully
some
understood,
information.
And don't take my comment as in any way negative towards having this brought up. But the proper place would be under new business so that all members of the board would have the opportunity to come prepared and discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
And that more
makes
has
sense.
To do with making sure the process is understood by the public and that we respect what we tell the public the process is.
I concur completely, and that's one of the reasons I brought all these articles.
Could you
make sure that your contact information is with staff before you go so
sure.
that we can see if you can join us and we can
sure.
schedule, put a future
sure.
agenda item, and
sure.
have you come in and
I'd
give
be happy
a presentation?
To.
Including the...
To these articles. But Google is your friend. That's how I do my research. I just put in the keywords of what I really want to know about. But, and maybe...
Thank you very much for your input and for your comments. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate you coming to our meeting.
Thank you for
so
listening.
We seldom have guests.
Thank you.
Okay. Next item number 7: minutes from our last meeting. Does anybody have any corrections to the minutes? And if not, is there a motion to accept as they are?
I move to accept the minute.
Second, all in favor?
Aye.
It's unanimous. I should say all opposed, just in case. It's unanimous.
Well, I have to abstain because I wasn't here.
Okay, one abstention from Olson. Thank you, Bill. All right, number 8, director's report. And which one of you would like to go first?
I'll jump on in. So
okay, thank
something
you,
a little bit more mundane, perhaps.
Mr. Boucher has the microphone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to bring you up to date on a couple items. As you see in the director's report, there's been quite a bit going on. First of all, the roundabout project at Morro Bay Boulevard and Quintana Road, we put the project out to bid. We had received a Caltrans encroachment permit in early September. We incorporated the permit conditions into the plans and specifications, put them towards both getting the project up and running and to retain the funding. The project needs to have an executed contract by the end of December, and we're looking at ways that we can try to make that happen. The next one, which is probably more confusing, is the Harbor Walk project. And perhaps I kind of did a mind dump on you on this one, for which I apologize, but I tried to be brief, but it just wasn't happening. Maybe as a point of clarification, I should point out that there are two sources of funding for this project. One is state money through the State Coastal Conservancy, and the second is federal money through the Transmit Enhancement Act, T21. The federal money is regulated by the Federal Highways Administration. And in the state of California, Caltrans is the designated administrator on behalf of FHWA. So the project is basically overseen by Caltrans every step of the way. As you recall, we went to the Coastal Commission in the spring. They put some permit conditions on it. We took those permit conditions back to the City Council, and the Council decided that it was appropriate to accept those permit conditions. We then started on modifying the plans, and we put the project out to bid in early October. Again, this is a project that's supposed to be under contract by the end of December. Once we got out to bid, October 2nd is after October 1st. October 1st is the start of the new. So we started doing that, and it was kind of an awkward process. If you've dealt with state and federal paperwork, it's not fun. We've gone through a rather lengthy process, and just today I received a phone call that Caltrans has approved our plans and specifications, and they have now authorized us to go out to bid. The downside is neither the Coastal Commission nor Coastal Conservancy have approved the plans yet, so we need to talk amongst ourselves on what risk that poses of going out to bid without those approvals, perhaps, and we would certainly be looking at contract change orders in the event that there are any changes that are mandated. As you also may recall, we had the requirement to prepare a dunes enhancement plan for this project and for the adjacent property. We submitted those plans to the Coastal Commission for their review and approval, and again, we've not heard anything from them on that. I've emailed them a few times and have not heard back. In response to that, and we kind of feel that these conditions, the Caltrans review, Coastal Conservancy, and Coastal Commission review processes are beyond our control. We don't know that we can, if we were ready to go to bid today, we would, you have to give the contractors a bare minimum of a month to put together a bid on $1.5 million project. And when you've got the holidays in the way, I would like to give them more time than that. So the likelihood of us being in a position where we could have an executed contract by the end of December is pretty slim. So we have submitted a request to the California Transportation Commission for a delay, and I'll be doing a road show in December to the CTC to put forth our case in that regard. I have talked to the Coastal Conservancy staffer. They're sensitive to the issues. They've indicated that they will support us. The local Caltrans District 5 people have also, and that there may not be as much of an issue of concern of the Transportation Commission taking funding from local agencies to redistribute it to the state for state projects. That's been the big concern, and that's why we thought they put on these really short deadlines to be under contract after the allocation of the funds, is that, one, they want to hold your feet to the fire, which is fair enough, but the period that they gave us really isn't enough time to do a complicated, lengthy process. And so there's on the back of your mind, say, you give somebody an unrealistic deadline, you want the money back. So we're working towards that, and I'm getting ready to go make my pitch at the CTC in December.
I'm just confused on the sequence in the current plan. The going to bid is now being held till you hear from the Coastal Conservancy and the Coastal Commission.
They have both informed us recently that we knew that advertising it for bids.
Yeah.
We knew that the Coastal Commission permit is not effective until they approve the plans.
Yeah.
We knew that the successful contractor will have to prepare a stormwater plan that has to be submitted to the Coastal Commission for their approval. So me, looking at it in a simplistic way, thought that there was time because that this could all be done during the...
Which started the whole...
Well, that was what started all the federal issues.
Next time we'll do it September 30th.
It's kind of a multi-headed beast.
Yeah.
And only recently after I did my last submittal was I informed, oh, by the way, you do know that the federal prevailing wage rates just changed in November.
So when September 30th is a highlight, and that flushed out the Coastal Conservancy view,
they then received the plans, and these issues started to come to light.
Is there a possibility this might be completed for the tourist season coming up, summer?
There is 07? A very good possibility that, well, we know that the first thing that will happen is that the road will be moved. That's the first thing. So if we work under the presumption that the road gets moved first, then the tourist traffic to the rock will not be unduly disrupted. I don't think that we'll be done with all the walkways and the amenities before Memorial Day. We have issued the notice to proceed for the design and construction of the fire department apparatus bay on Bonita Street. They're starting their design. We anticipate they'll get some draft plans to us here in about a month, and then we'll be proceeding along those in that effort. Last Monday night, the City Council adopted the second of the two phases of the interim sewer rate increases. On October 28th, they approved our recommendation for a 20% increase. They adopted that second and final interim rate increase Monday night. The state water shutdown, I think we've gone through in detail, but we've spoken to the state water people, and they have told us that we're slated to come back online at noon on Monday. Having said that, I will pass it off to Frank and Janine for their portion. Or if you have any questions on any of the items, I'll be more than happy to answer them.
Anyone? No questions for Bill? All right. Who would like to go second?
Excuse me.
Go ahead, Roger.
I'm sorry. I missed one, Bill. On Roger Pelletier is retiring, I noticed.
Yes, he is.
Will his position be refilled?
I will defer to Mr. Cunningham.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Oh, all right.
Well, you might as well go for it, Frank.
Yeah, it was actually going to be included in mine. If you have any more questions for Bill, if you want to pursue.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, then I'll jump
right
in.
Thank you, Mr. Boucher. Go ahead, Frank.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the board. Well, I'll jump down on the first page under local streets maintenance projects, and I'll sort of trump Mr. Boucher here as I have a contract. I'm going forward. Monday night at City Council, we had a bid opening the week before, took it to Council for award. The contract for the South Bay Boulevard overlay possible for, and if you go back and look at our organizational chart, you'll see two people under street maintenance. It's very, very difficult for two guys to get out there and try to do potholes. You know, you just can't do it without traffic control, and you know, you need two or three people just for traffic control, much less dig outs and potholes. So we should be moving forward on that one. It's not really covered in there, but I wanted to jump back to creek maintenance. You know, we went through that issue. We got kind of a late start, but I did want to let you know that I feel comfortable that we jumped into the creeks, and I feel comfortable that the creeks are in pretty good shape for the winter. We had the city street crew out there with the CMC crews, which I would like to commend. They did a wonderful job this year. Because we did get a late start and the creeks hadn't been jumped on in a couple of years, there was a lot of growth out there. We wound up going in and kind of enhancing those efforts by using some goats, weed-eating goats, out at Del Mar Park and for a couple of days at Lila Kaiser. So it was kind of fun. It was, you know, something we tried, and actually it panned out pretty well. So I have a few little hot spots to go after in some residential you know, backyard creeks, but for the most part, the Alvapals, the, you know, Morrill Creek, I think are in pretty good shape for the upcoming winter. Moving right down under the main Radcliffe intersection, I wanted to bring it to your attention in case you didn't see Monday night's city council. The Main Street Radcliffe realignment was brought up by Councilwoman DeMeritt. She wants to agendize it as a future item.
Currently, Frank, what is the status on the with the Giannini development?
Still moving. You know, I about once a month, I you know, I get a little meeting between Giannini's and, you know, Canon, and, you know, they keep tossing around with PG&E because a lot of it involves, you know, a lot of PG&E easements up there along the top, all the big, you know, towers and so on and so forth. So they're struggling to try to get good access and, you know, viable use of their property up there. And I think they've even had some discussions with county. Some of their property is actually outside city limits. So there's
some of the PG&E.
Well, it's Giannini property.
And this is up at the top of Radcliffe?
Up at the top of Radcliffe and over the hill towards Little Morrill Creek. So it's still there. You know, I think they're moving at a, you know, nice, slow, conservative pace because it's not an easy project, but it is there. You know, the city has been collecting some traffic impact fees. I'm going to guess there's maybe $50,000 or $60,000 in that cover. So, and Canon has submitted a couple of proposed realignments, which I happen to like. So when it comes out, it'll be interesting to kind of see it.
Thank you.
More to come. On the note of Roger Pelletier, yes, he is retiring after 22 years on December 8th. So I was going to nothing out, throw out an invitation, stop by the office, say hello, say goodbye. Please don't make it on a Wednesday. Mr. Pelletier is practicing early retirement. He's taking Wednesdays off to go play golf. So
got to figure out when he's actually going to be there. That's one of the first hurdles we need to cross.
All right, Could you guys send us out an email and let us know, please? Yeah,
no problem.
Sorry, I didn't mean to push you into something.
We're just the last to know.
Thank you, Roger's going to be hiding.
Now, but is it going to be refilled? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Right now, with Mr. Ambo, Public Services Director, has been going through a phase of reorganization of the public services. And as you notice, the organizational chart has changed dramatically. Yes. Mr. Dave Phillips left, and golly gee, Mr. Boucher and I sort of took over a lot of those responsibilities, some of which were also tossed down to, you know, water and collections. So basically, other staff, the remaining staff did more with less, as we've been trying to do over the last 3 years. So my understanding with Mr. Ambo is we are going to try to not refill that position. Some of the duties that Roger does in the water sampling and testing will be pushed out to, you know, Mr. Boucher and water ops. So
you guys are like going to be gigantic gophers by the time this is done, aren't you? You just do everything.
Are you saying then that
hostile takeover?
We may not have anybody on staff that is officially in charge of trees and taking a look at whether or not.
I take offense to that.
Well, make it an oak fence, and I'll accept it.
No, tree issues. The good part is with Roger leaving, mm-hmm. you know, it's winter, and the trees that Roger goes out and waters, I'm not going to worry about for a few months here. But come spring and summer, I will address that when I get to it. And if you see me side by side with Roger in a lot of those determinations, unfortunately, I'm the bad guy who took out some major eucalyptus, you know, Riley trees and all that good stuff. So, you know, I've been there. I feel reasonably comfortable. Plus, we have some pretty good contract arborists. You know, a lot of times when somebody's making a recommendation or, you know, a threatening letter, we bring an arborist to make a good determination to get to the facts. And if the tree needs to come out, it's usually based on a determination by a registered arborist.
Thank you. Yeah. That's really what my concern was, and you've answered it. Thank you very much.
On that, Frank, do we have a listing of, I know our schedule is when a tree comes out for cause, is diseased or needs to come out, it's replaced 1-to-1. If it needs to come out for other reasons, it's replaced 2-to-1. Is there a list or a schedule of where those trees are and whether or not, I mean, do you have a checked off list to say they've been replaced, they have not?
Well, we have an approved city street tree list.
No, I'm not mean the list. I mean the actual replacement of the trees. When a tree comes out, how long is it before the two trees are replaced?
Well, that goes usually through the process of either development, you know, if they're proposing to take out some trees. Sometimes planning, you know, planning gets involved. So if a development comes in and they're planning on taking out 10 trees, Planning Commission and City Council, you saw them on Monday night. They were jumping around making a determination of the Colmer project, and they're taking out X amount of trees, and they were discussing whether it should be at a 2-to-1 ratio or a 3-to-1 ratio. So it's not a cut-and-dry policy. There is a major vegetation ordinance within the city that gives you basic guidelines, but, you know, sometimes...
So say, like, if somebody...
Individual permit to remove a tree, or it's part of a development project, it's part of a permit process, and it's tracked. The replacement is tracked through the permit process. So when the trees are replaced is before the development is finaled.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is, in a particular place where a tree is taken out on a residence, there's no other building other than, say, an addition, and a tree is taken out because a new water line or something has to go in, where would there's nothing wrong with the tree other than it's in the way of the new water line, where would the two trees, how long would it be before the two trees would be planted?
One tree.
Is it supposed to be 1-to-1 if it's a diseased tree and 2-to-1 if it's taken out for other reasons, right?
Not that I'm aware of. Some of that major vegetation ordinance changed, so it's more over in the planning side of it. But if somebody's coming and doing some room addition or something, and a city tree has to be removed, you know, and it's for a water line, and let's say he's got a 50-foot lot and there's just absolutely no place to put a city tree without, you know, causing a hazard.
Right.
Remember, that's where we had that little list of people who wanted a tree in front of their house. So in a way, we mitigated by not replacing that tree somewhere else in the city. So we did have...
I was just curious about the timeline of how long it generally takes.
Well, as Bill said, you know, by the time they look for sign-off on their permit or occupancy of their building, they have to have all those conditions done.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you still guys you have that active list where if a person would like to have a tree planted, you know, on their property, that you can do that?
Yes, and we... encourage people, if they want to have trees on the property, to contact us.
And those are street trees, right?
Point. So,
okay. So they would come into public services, or I mean, it's the same counter, I know, between planning and public services. They would be able to just come in and get on that list.
Oh, you bet.
Well, all those trees on our street have been taken down through the years, and only one has been replaced. And that magnificent tree that was across the street from us, you know, that thing was taken down a couple of years ago. A replacement tree was put in, and I was doing watering, you know. And I was that's a tree I was watering. That tree is no longer there now.
You killed it?
Not I. And there was one in back of that house that I was watering, and that is gone. And that was a beautiful tree. And down the street a ways, there's another one I was watering, which has wound up on a tilt. I don't know what's going to happen with that poor tree. But out of those three trees, there's only one is surviving now, and I say it's tilted.
Now we don't pretend to know what the regulations are for private property. Yeah, we are the public rights of way. So, but it's been my understanding that a person can remove a tree on their property pretty much when they want, without a permit, and I think it goes up to a maximum of 4 per calendar year. So can trees be removed without replacement? Absolutely. So under that scenario, you know, that's a different bird.
But
so
these are city trees. They're in the city right away. They were within that 60-foot right away, you know.
Well, then I'll blame it on Roger.
Damn.
But no, if it's a tree that was planted as a mitigation, it certainly needs to be monitored.
A nice little map in the office that actually has a little dot for every known city tree. So if all of a sudden one's missing, because let's face it, we just don't have the staff or the time to be driving out there. And, you know, the infamous weekend warriors, people come in there and it's like sometimes brush and trees and stuff, especially when they're small. You know, if they're only a year or two old, oops, I don't like that. I'm getting rid of it, and it's gone.
Well, our street is now a rhapsody of telephone poles. It used to be a row of Monterey pines. You know, so we have that's all that's left is a telephone poles.
Maybe we can decorate the telephone poles.
Yeah, put branches on the telephone poles, maybe.
A question here. Do you have any people on the list of people that want trees that are not able to be, that you're not able to plant a tree in their yard for funding reasons, or is everyone being taken care of?
Well, we usually get to the list of people wanting trees on a mitigation basis. So when we run across an opportunity where somebody's doing something, a room addition or development, and there's just really, usually we try to require a tree every 50 feet. But, you know, with driveways and site distance and sidewalks and just whatever, if there's just not the opportunity to put it in there, then we refer to this waiting list. And some of the people have been on the waiting list for a while. So.
Meaning that you don't have the funding to give them a tree?
Well, we, the city, don't try to furnish them. Remember, this is developers or a homeowner doing something, and if they're not able to, if they're not physically able to put that tree on their parcel, then we turn around and say, okay, well, instead of it putting on your property, we'll allow you to come over to this person's house, dig a hole, and plant their tree. Because they want it, and they'll usually water it, and they'll take care of it. And
seem like there should be anybody waiting if trees are, you know.
It doesn't happen that often that a developer can't put it in. It's just, you know, like I said, it's a couple trees maybe a year that all of a sudden we can't find a place for it on the lot due to restraints where we're turning to our waiting list.
To follow up on the funding issue, if I understand it, the city funding issue would be related to putting trees in the city right of way. Those individuals on the waiting list who would be happy to have a tree on their property can go immediately, and it's their property, and plant the tree.
Absolutely.
So it's a funding issue, but it's a personal funding issue, saying the tree's important to me, but I'll wait through this mechanism. Or people may have gone ahead and already done it, and they're on the list because it doesn't happen often. Funding would be a matter, though, for more trees in our right-of-way.
And basically, this just went through city council as just an announcement that if you're interested in having a tree put out in your front yard that would be a city tree, call public services and get on their list. And when the opportunity comes up where a tree needs to be planted to, you know, for some other development or whatever, that, you know, you'd be available.
To clarify, though, it's in someone's front yard and called a city tree, as you said it, that individual still is responsible for the maintenance. The city won't come around. And if it was put in as a mitigation, the city isn't going to come trim it and that kind of thing like you would a tree in the right-of-way.
Well, you're crossing into reality and sort of theoretical. And we've actually gotten away from some of our old details where the trees were in tree wells in the middle of the sidewalk. It kind of separated them from the houses. We changed our details to actually put the trees on the back of the sidewalk, which in many cases are in people's front yards. And the reason we did that, one, to get them away from the parked cars and the opening the doors and lifting up the curbs, gutters, and sidewalks. And it also kind of empowered the property owners to say, this is a tree in my front yard where they have grass and landscaping and that they will water it and take care of it just like any other tree, but it's there for the benefit of, you know, the street and beautification, and it serves as a city tree. So.
Does the city have a specific source for the trees that are being brought in, landscaping materials, as far as specific nursery that the city utilizes, or is it, you know, pretty much wherever you can find what you need?
Well, remember, we don't go off and buy trees very often. We rely on developers and homeowners. I mean, on occasion, you know, a city tree dies and Roger will it's fallen or it's a hazard and we take it out. And that's when Roger does go and purchase a tree and he'll go out and replant it and take care of it for, you know, a year or two until it's established. And I'm really not aware that he goes to any particular nursery. Yeah. We spread our. On to the next one. At the very bottom of the page, 204, the aspects of there are some new sidewalks and ADA ramps, either already in or very close to being put in. This is down here, you know, the Michael Koss project down on Moro, kind of Driftwood and Moro around the Koss project. So there's stuff happening. The Moro Bay Motel, which we refer to a lot of times as the Patel Motel next to the Motel 6, they're doing frontage improvements out there, so there'll be new curb gutter sidewalk and a handicap ramp across the, you know, southbound on-ramp there. So we, you know, we got some improvements coming in.
I have a question, if I may, please, Frank. When you mentioned ADA ramps near the Mike Koss project, are those funds coming from the developer?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. On the last page, the MTBE issue, I, for the most part, Bill brought it up with the water issue. We are getting down into those last phases of checking out as many things as we possibly can. The Shell Equilon group is trying to, well, they've submitted clean closure papers to the regional board. We've had our discussions with the regional board. They're doing some final last few tests, one of which was the heavy pumping of the Moro well field during the state water shutdown. The Shell Equilon group will actually be going out and doing a little bit of probing out in the Caltrans median, you know, Highway 1 right-of-way out there, you know, in the middle between the two freeways, just again to see if there's any possibility of residual MTB plume that we're not aware of. So there's things happening, but I suspect over the next probably 3 months, you know, we're either going to find some detections or we're going to be moving towards clean closure with the Regional Water Quality Control Board. Noted on there, that's the latest information I got from the developers was 4 to 6 weeks. It raised a few eyebrows, got several phone calls saying, oh, you know, why does it take 4 to 6 weeks? Unfortunately, it is under the discretion of the developer. He's putting in lights out there. He wants it lit. He's really not done with the landscaping yet. And then he needs to put up those lights, which are that run between the bike path and the parking lot, because there is a step there, a curb. He needs to put up a construction safety fence between the bike path and his development and parking lot, and they need to finish the landscaping. So I think on a conservative basis, he said, you know, four to six weeks.
I have an issue on this project that I'd like to ask you about. And every time I drive by this project, which is at least twice a day, there is a, I don't know if it's the sewer outfall or outlet or whatever, but there are two pipes that stick straight up, very, very narrow, very high, just to the east of the bike path between Main Street and the bike path. Do you know what I'm talking about? Towards the south end of the project on the hillside between the street and the bike path.
Yeah.
Those, I mean, you can't miss it. I don't know what
they're. But they're small tubes? I mean, they.
No, it's a large.
Is it by the backflow preventer? The big backflow preventer encased by the Allen Block retaining walls?
There's nothing around them, and that's what bothers me.
Well, I mean, they could be conduits for the.
They're about maybe an inch and a half in diameter. And they're between, they're on the hillside between Main Street and this proposed bike path and the parking lot. And I don't know what they are, but what worries me is somebody coming along at night or during the day, kids get very raucous. Somebody might fall off that bike path and land on top of these things.
Oh, so it's up near the top there at the hinge
yes.
point.
And I'm wondering if there is a way in which we could require the developer to somehow put a protective covering.
Well, I'll find out what they are. And, you know, this is part of my job is to go and evaluate for public safety. And before we open the bike path, we will certainly – that's actually why we want to get the landscaping in is I don't want little Johnny, you know, 8-year-old Johnny riding his bike and then tumbling down the
right,
hill into Main
exactly.
Street. So,
yeah. Okay. I would appreciate that.
Well, now you piqued my curiosity.
I wish I knew what these were. I mean, you can't miss them.
Yeah.
All you got to do is look to your left as you're going north, and you see these two.
I'm going to laugh if it's just something they just stuck in the dirt just to
no,
just to store it there.
No, it required an engineering feet to put these two things in. I just don't know what they are. But they look very ominous from a young person on a bicycle riding above it, to me anyway. I could be very wrong, but I'm glad you got a look at it. Thank you, Frank.
You know, a comment on the bike lane, because I went up there before the meeting today. I just wanted to see how close they were to putting them in. I saw something that looked very much like what you're describing, but it was obviously going to be a light pole. They were light poles along the bike path, on the west side of the bike path. Shrubs that are there are so minuscule, they're not going to keep anyone from rolling down that hill.
Well, they're not done
at
yet.
At this point.
Yeah. So did you try tumbling down the hill to see if you could make it all the way to Main Street?
Thanks. No.
Okay. Good.
Does that mean we're going to post weight limits for people who ride because the shrubs would only be able to, no, I'm just being...
Stop it. You're torturing me. Madam Chair, that's all I had. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Frank. Does anyone have any questions for Frank? I hear no takers. Mr. Cunningham?
Wait, I do have one. If you, Frank, if you do come across and figure out what this contraption is that I'm trying to describe, I'd appreciate you letting
I'll
me
I'll pick
know.
It up and stick it in the back of my car. I'll bring it to you.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Frank. Janine, did you have anything on the director's report other than the...
I have two quick things.
Okay, thank you very much.
One that I know you have read, but for the public who will be seeing this later... Charter has notified the city that there is now a local payment center in Morro Bay for customers who wish to pay their bills in Morro Bay. We had given them information for the senior center because they do that kind of thing with some of the other utilities and whatnot, and they were also working on a Western Union thing, which apparently didn't happen as well. So the Lucky 7 market at 1860 Main Street,
well,
we've been told by
located.
We've been told by Charter we'll be accepting payments for their for the cable service. So that's the first announcement.
Is, that, is that the old Circle K north of 41?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's the one just north of the old Shell station. For those who don't know what 1860 is. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Another comment I would like to make is the long-awaited North Coast Transit Plan.
You mean the one we were getting in February?
The one we were supposed to get some draft stuff in February and March and then the summer and then a whole bunch of other stuff. I physically have it. The city has received, we received it on Monday, so I did want to let you know because when we were doing the staff report for tonight, it was anticipated to be received by a particular date. And I just wanted to let you know it does exist. It's here. We'll be taking a look at it. And we're tentatively going to be scheduling this, as it says here, for your December 20th meeting. And then it would go, comments and recommendations would go on to the council at their January 8th meeting. So that was my only other comment. And I would be happy to answer any other questions you may have. And teeny tiny print.
Ooh, my favorite.
But this was sent to the city electronically, so I'm going to be working with Steve Doerr, our IT person, on kind of separating it out maybe by chapters or something and having it posted on the city's website so that I don't, one, have to make copies of this for everyone, and you can more easily access it if it's broken down than if it's all together like this.
That's
so.
Like a 3/4 of an inch thick there. Well, I understand that one of the advancements of technology in the workforce is not more information, but bigger, prettier documents.
Yes.
So
more use of paper.
To keep everyone busier reading things. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a wonderful evening.
And Janine will tell you when it comes up on the future, the next month's agenda. But I just want to let you know the SLOCOG has been holding public meetings on the Scenic Byways Plan and the Community Gateways Plan. They want to bring both of those to you next month. So those two items should be on your agenda in addition to the pound of flesh that she's got over there document. So
it's going to be a long December meeting. We'll be here until...
We'll have a study session.
And that was the scenic byways?
Yes.
And what was the other one?
It's a community gateways.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on. We have old business as our item number 9, and we have none. Item 10, new business. And Janine, again with us, has a report on AB 2987, which has to do with franchises and video, which I believe means cable.
Yes.
Janine, please take it away.
Thank you. The city attorney had put together some information, a summary, and kind of some of the major highlights of AB 2987, which is the Digital Infrastructure and Video Competition Act of 2006. Big, long title, which basically means that the public utility, the California Public Utilities Code will be amended here. And right now, the act is effective January 1st, 2007, so just in barely a month and a half from now. And earlier this month, the Public Utilities Commission has been putting together and has opened a rulemaking proceeding to adopt rules for issuing state franchises. And what this means is you cannot change the law. You can't make additions to the law. This is the PUC developing and establishing the rules by which they will be enacting the legislation that they have been given. And it's only in relation to those areas related to the Public Utilities Commission. So as you'll see later in the report, that, like, for example, an issue with customer service standards where the act says the local franchising authority, i.e. the city, or actually local entity, they call us at that point, the city's responsible for enforcing customer service standards that are adopted by the state and the federal government. So they won't be developing rules on how that's done. So this is just the rulemaking is just for those areas relating to the PUC.
Jenny, I'm just
yes.
standing because of the back
problem. Okay.
So
go right ahead. And just real briefly, the main purpose for the act is to create a streamlined process for granting franchise to providers of video service. And right now, the existing process had been that if a cable operator, or now as telephone companies are wanting to get into the business of providing video service, they would have to go to each and every operator, such as Charter or a telephone company who wants to get into the video services, and would go to the state to obtain the franchise. And the legislation sets up some procedures for when and what and how that can be done. The process is a lot shorter in the state franchising process than typically you see for local franchising. And they have set, basically the law sets that, I think ultimately it's something like within 45 days of an application received, a franchise is given. The only time a franchise would not be given is if there's particular information that is required in law to be provided to make a determination whether they basically fit the law, which is providing this particular information. If there's something missing from that application, then the state would notify the proposed state holder that this particular information is lacking, and they would have a certain number of days in order to provide it. If by the end of that period of time the state has not made a determination one way or another, the franchise is granted. State franchises would be valid for 10 years, and renewals would be for 10 years. There is allowing for transfers of the state franchise from one company to another, much, you know, similar to what we have in our current agreement where there's the ability to transfer to another company. And essentially the process could be applied for by a company who has an existing franchise in the city. So it only needs to meet one of these. The first is the expiration of the existing franchise agreement with the local franchising authority. Our current agreement expires in March 31st of 2013. The second would be if the city and Charter mutually agree to terminate the agreement so that Charter could go get a state franchise. And the third would be when a video service provider who holds a state franchise, so if a telephone company or another cable operator got a state franchise and then notified the city that within as little as 10 days or as many as 60 days, we're going to come into your community and start providing service, then Charter would have the opportunity to terminate the local franchise agreement it has and then have a state franchise. The local franchise agreement would be in effect until a state franchise had been obtained by Charter at that point.
Does that mean that's not a competitive thing where another company could come in and offer services? There would still be no competition. There would still be one choice of a franchise cable company in a given city.
No. There could be a telephone company that comes in. I don't know why another cable operator might do this, but another cable operator could come in, build their infrastructure, and provide service as well. So build their own system and to provide service.
Good. Janine, let me ask you a question then. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, just to make sure I understand it. There could be given permission by the state, a franchise, to two different organizations then, two different entities, maybe AT&T and Charter. Could
yes.
both have the right to market their products here in Morro Bay?
Yes.
Okay. And then we'd have a choice.
Yes, at that point you would.
I'd like to just clarify that if there's a state franchise holder that gives the notice they're going to want to provide services, does Charter have the option to abrogate its agreement and say we're not going to provide services at all?
No. Well, what would happen is
or they only have the option to switch to the state.
They would only have the option to switch to the state franchise process and get a state franchise so that conditions that are in the current agreement for franchise fee or if we have public education and government access channel requirements and things like that, a good example would be the limited income discount, which we have in our current agreement, but which under the state process does not exist. Then Charter would have to comply with my understanding is they comply with the existing conditions until our franchise agreement would have expired. So if in 2009 a phone company comes in, gives us notice that they're a state franchise holder, that they're going to come in and provide service, Charter then says, okay, I'm going to go get a state franchise. They obtain one. And in 2010, say...
There's no way they get out of the current agreement.
Not until 2013.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
As far as who owns the... or who issues the franchise at
that
point.
That's different. And then
right.
any investments they've made in hookups of or studios or stuff have to remain?
Yes.
Okay, but competitors don't have to do that.
Well, if you let me go through some of the, we touch on some of the items like franchise fee and PEG fees and things like that. Mm-hmm. On to the next topic is the franchise fee. The Act would establish a 5% franchise fee of the annual gross revenues as a rent or toll for use of the public rights away. Unless the local entity has an ordinance adopted that sets an amount less than 5%, which I don't know why they would, but and the 5% percentage applied to the local entity and the incumbent cable operator, whichever is less. Our current agreement is a 5% franchise fee, and that's the maximum that has been allowed by the federal government. So whenever the state franchise process is put into place, if a telephone company comes in, if Charter eventually gets a state franchise 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road, we would still have 5% as the franchise fee, so we're not really losing out there. The act also describes a little bit about when they're due, if it's late, what kind of late fee is assessed and whatnot. The current agreement has that the 30 days from the 60 when it was due would be considered late. So it's a lot shorter time frame for the quarterly payment to be submitted, and it is a very short period of time for it to be determined if it's late. Going on to public educational and government access provisions, the state agreement or the state franchise would require that providers have the same number of public education and government access channels as are activated by the incumbent operator. So what that means is if a phone company were to get a state franchise and notify the city that they were going to come in to provide service, our existing agreement with Charter sets aside three channels, well, actually four, a citywide public education government access and then a countywide public access channel. Or is it countywide government, Nancy?
Well, government.
So we basically have, in our agreement, we require four channels, three which are for the local, one for the countywide. And so the state franchise holder coming in would have to provide the same number of channels. And then there's some provisions in there about how they have to have the channels in the lowest tier group, so they can't put it in, like, have a basic tier, an expanded tier like we have, and put it in the expanded tier. It has to be in the lowest cost tier. They can't do things like move the channels to a different channel number without approval from the city basis, which is unlikely that that would happen here locally because we don't have a lot of, I mean, other than the Brown Act meetings we have here, we don't have a lot of original programming. So we might not hit that. But there are provisions in there that allow for that. So if that threshold were to be made, additional channels would be required.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Under this new contract, is there any way at all that PEG access could be threatened beyond what we already have?
Not that that I've been given to understand about what the legislation is. We currently have the four channels, and the act indicates that any new state franchise holder coming in would have to provide the same number of channels as your existing local contract.
All right.
That's set by, I think it's what's existing on January 1, 2007. So what we have in our current agreement come a month and a half from now, it would be what, as far as for the channels, is would be what a newcomer into the city would have to provide as well.
Then when our franchise agreement with Charter expires in 2013, will they still have to agree to the PEG access rules that we are under right now?
They would then fall under what is provided for in the state franchising process.
And does the state franchising process protect our PEG access as we have now?
From what I understand, it requires, three.
Okay. So, basically,
could I ask about franchise fees?
Sure.
That covered that. It says the franchise, no fee shall become due unless the local entity provides documentation to the state franchise holder supporting the percentage paid, which just is the documents that it's 5%.
Right. It would just be, here's our franchise agreement.
It says the fee may be used for any local, by the local entity for any lawful purpose. What are the fees used for now, and what is the scope of the lawful purpose? So what are they used for now?
The franchise fees that we get go into the general fund, and from there, there's not a specific policy that says,
okay,
cable fees go to these things.
So they meant
typically, the justification for the franchise fee in the past has been that it's used for streets and roads because that's where the cable systems they operate in, they tear up, they put down on the streets and roads. So
what is the current amount? Do you have a sense?
I want to say it's somewhere in the $130,000-$150,000 range per year. But I could be confusing that with the garbage franchise fee.
No, you have more than one franchise to handle, I'm sure.
I'm trying to remember.
Well, that's
no, yeah, actually, I think it's more than that because I want to say.
But it.
The PEG fee that we get is 1% of the gross revenue, and that's in the $7,000 to $8,000 per month range.
So
four times it's close to $30,000.
So any lawful purpose meant any lawful.
That I am not exactly clear on. They do set up. I don't remember the name. They do set up a revenue and taxation code where. I think from the application process, they're allowed to charge a fee, and it's put in there. So I would think that that fee for the application process is what is used to fund the state doing their part for the state franchising process.
As I understood it, it's the local entity that sends the bill still from the review. The state won't collect the money and send it to us.
But
you're talking about the franchise fee.
The franchise fee.
And she was speaking to how does the state fund the administration of this. Okay. The other item with regard to PEG is the PEG support. Our current agreement, we have a 1% of the gross revenue that is submitted to the city on a quarterly basis with the franchise fees that is used for PEG support. It's used. There's a listing within our current agreement that talks about the things that it could be used for. We can use it for equipment or facilities. So if the council at some point in time wanted to change the council chambers and have an automated equipment that's needed to access from, like, our computer servers, the routers and whatnot, to the institutional network, funding could be used for that as well. The state franchise agreement, the legislation that was passed, provided for a 1% fee as well for PEG support. And that, as I mentioned before, is remitted quarterly with the franchise fee payment as well. So it's two separate fees that go into two separate areas.
I would just like to clarify with reference to the PEG fee, are the limitations on its use set in state law, or can that end up in the general fund too if our agreement were different?
You know, I'm not remembering offhand if there were specifics in the legislation that said what the PEG funding could be used for. I would have to go back and look at that to make sure if it's something that is along the lines of what we currently have in our agreement, or if it at some point can get put into the general fund and be used for other purposes. I'm tending to think not, because it is a
separate.
Fee.
Yeah.
For PEG that's separate from the franchise fee. But as I've read through the legislation, I don't know if anyone else has pulled it offline and looked at it, there are some things where it's just, how does this work? Well, I don't know. And it's not really specifically clear how some things are to work. But that is something I can look at. And we have similar language in our current agreement, so there's not a real big deviation from that.
Like our water situation?
Like the water situation that happened today, that could be something that could potentially be put in, broken in, and doing the emergency alert notification. So and the other stuff within here is getting into things like rights-of-way management. It just talks about how the city cannot sort of be obstructive in with the rights-of-way issues. And we still have the ability to, if the telephone company or if Charter is going to be working in the public right of way, they do need to get an encroachment permit. There's a process they would need to go through, and they would still have to go through that process with the city. So the state franchising process is not taking that away from the city. The city still has the ability to do that, but we can't just be obstructive with it, which we haven't been. So, and that's, I mean, those are the basic big. Oh, well, one of the others, customer service standards. This is an area that's sort of that gray area. The state franchising process states that the local entity will enforce all customer service and protection standards. These are standards that are adopted by the state or the federal government. The local entity has no control over it. We can't add to it. We can't augment it. We can't do anything other than enforce what the state and federal government have already adopted.
So that would
say, is it as detailed as what we have in our current agreement, or is it a lot looser, or is it more detailed? And that I just don't know at this point. It also allows for the local entity to adopt a schedule or a policy for monetary damages for those instances where a material breach of the customer service standards has occurred. Notification had been given to the franchise holder to remedy the issue, and the date came and went, and it still was unremedied. And my understanding from what the city attorney has provided is that the monetary penalty that would be imposed, half of it would go to the state and be deposited into their digital divide account. I don't know what exactly that count does. And then I'm assuming the other half is retained locally as an offset for the city having to take on this enforcement issues. Otherwise, it's basically an unfunded mandate at that point. So that half of the penalty fee goes to the state, half stays with the city.
Is there any possibility, as this, at least to monitor as this begins to get implemented, working with other cities or local entities, whether it be the county or other cities, rather than everyone having their own pool resources to be able to have work on these issues with providers? Just to think in the future that
it's
a
something
lot of small cities like the five cities might want to come together rather than everyone having to do it independently.
It is something to consider looking at down the road when we actually get to January 1 and this is all starting.
The
class action lawsuit.
And then
to, it's limited to 3 days.
I think a comment was made about the issue of low income. Mm-hmm. Under discrimination, as I understand it, it says state franchise holders with more than 1 million telephone customers in California, this is on page 6, must satisfy the following requirements. So why it says telephone customers is confusing to me.
Because the telephone company might be doing it.
This is for a provision where where the state franchise holder might be a telephone company versus a cable operator. So instead of their, like the Charter has equipment, wires, cables physically on public rights of ways, telephone companies have a much more limited and less intrusive network to provide their service. So what this is referring to is I'm pretty sure is for those state franchise holders who are telephone companies who meet that.
Well, what it lists is it says within X number of 3 years after it begins providing service, at least 25% of the households with access to service are low income. Cut out our service areas where not many people subscribe because they can't afford it. Cut the cables, not maintain them.
Well, I was going to say, here's the other thing. Charter is getting into the telephone business.
So
you'll probably see that happening with all cable operators. They will be getting into the telephone business because by necessity, they're going to have to.
So these then would be helpful, meaning they're going to have to stay wired in those areas. It's a separate issue what the fee structure will be. As I understand it, it's at least 25% of the households with access are low income, not 25% of their customer base. As I understand that.
So access to the service.
And then finally, providing free service to community centers at a ratio of one community center for every 10,000 video customers means we're shut out.
We have over 10,000 residents, but not over
because
10,000 cable customers.
It's individual franchise. So even though if you add Los Osos,
which is not part of the city.
Anything outside of the city. So that, okay.
How does this new contract status affect DISH satellite?
This has nothing to do with the satellite networks or the satellite providers.
So those who are hooked up to satellite?
They don't have very much regulation as it is. Whether new regulations will come down the road in future years, I can't say. It deals specifically with video service, the cable, cable television. The Wi-Fi is an entirely different thing. And I think maybe the legislation that the public speaker was being directed to or referred to is not this particular one. There's others out there that I am aware of that the industry is lobbying to prohibit cities and counties from having their own municipal networks, and I don't know, you know, because it's something that is off the radar. It's nothing that deals with our current franchise agreement. I'm not really paying attention to it, but it is kind of out there. I see it occasionally in the little telecommunication updates that I get. But I don't know at this point whether there's bills in both the state or the federal government and where they are, whether they're moving forward or languishing or just in a state in a holding pattern. So it's definitely a different legislation than what the state franchising one is.
Janine, do you see this as being positive for us? What do you see of the benefit or the disadvantage of this particular act?
You know, at this point in time, until it gets implemented and starts going, it's pretty hard to say. There's some areas where we have the same requirements that we do now that we will with the state franchise, like the franchise fee agreement. There's other areas, like I had mentioned, I don't know if it was earlier before the meeting or once we started, about the limited income. That first notice from a telephone company that says, I'm coming to town, and then see what happens from there. And that's pretty much, that's all the information I have that I'm aware of. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. As best
Janine,
I can.
Under advocacy, do you know if this division of ratepayer advocacy, is that something that's in existence now for cable customers? It's on page 8, the bottom of page 8.
I believe this is a division that is set up in the state franchise from the legislation, so my guess would be that there isn't something like that that currently exists. But the Telecommunications Act, I don't know if any of you have ever seen it. It is a lot of pages. So there may be something similar to that,
okay.
But at this point, I can't say whether there is or there isn't.
It could be an advantage in a small community like ours where we're fairly close-knit that if we did have problems banding together as citizens on something like that could resolve problems.
Right. With regard to rates, we're not allowed by the FCC to regulate them because a charter has applied for and been granted by the FCC. I can't remember now the specific term, but there was it's basically they file and say they have effective competition in the area. And they did this, and they sent this off to the state and or the FCC with the federal government, and it was approved. So that means that we can't regulate locally. And the FCC gave up regulation.
I want to clarify the low-income provisions in the current agreement in the sense of their potential longevity. Should another company get a state franchise and said, we're coming to Morro Bay, and all they have to do is say, we're coming, and try and market, and that allows Charter to switch to a state franchise. The low-income portions of the current agreement still have to be reflected in the state.
That is my understanding.
Okay. Until so that's good until 2000.
It's my understanding, and I would have to go back and talk with the city attorney about it and go back to the legislation and make sure, because in some of these areas of the legislation, it's talking about if it was talking about PEG, the Public Education and Government Access section, or the franchise fee mm-hmm. section. I'd have to make sure, go back and make sure that it was not just exclusively to these little areas that the state franchise was making sure was in there, but to the whole of the mm-hmm. existing agreement to the end of that agreement. Mm-hmm. And so I can't say with certainty that the limited income discount, if Charter in 3 years went and got a state franchise, that provision of the agreement that's existing today or existing January 1st of 2007 would be required, or if it's just these things that deal with franchise fees and the PEG channels and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Janine on this one? Okay. Janine, you just asked for us to...
summary of what it is and how it may play with the current agreement that we have.
Just that should anyone pursue a state franchise for this area, to agendize it immediately, just so we, or publicize it so we know who it is. And I'm concerned, I just want whoever comes in or starts doing it to hear from the get-go the commitment of the community on the low-income issue, which is, looks to be the thing that we're losing, potentially.
Well, the city cannot impose any. We can certainly let the incoming franchise holder know that this has been an issue. This is something that's in the current agreement. It would be nice if you do this, but there's no
fully
enforcement capability. Or authorization
fully
ability to be
that.
Able to do that.
It's a matter of setting a tone of a reputation that someone wants to get in a community. That's all. Fully understand.
Well, a city of 10,000 people is not much of a financial plum for anybody to want to come to.
This so, is probably
especially if we've already got some competition there. So I don't think there's much, you know, if I were running a business, I wouldn't try it. You can't get them to fill the empty stores around here either. You know, it's the same thing.
Okay. Any final questions for Janine? No, no takers. Janine, thank you very much. With the our public comment, the wireless, is it Wi-Fi?
Wi-Fi.
I would propose that and the all this correspondence on the bike path, not be next time, but as we do, we list them that they're going to be agendized.
Yeah,
because we have plenty, but to keep them on the list.
Mm-hmm. And for the record, when that does come up, the North Morro Bay Bike Lane, I talked to Robert Davis from the Morro Bay Bike Committee, and he said he's willing to come in when that is agendized and mm-hmm. be there
so
for that presentation.
We can keep the three things, the scenic byways, the community gateways, and transit issues for December.
Next.
We can also go ahead and say that we want for January's agenda, that we want to a discussion item for this Wi-Fi and the bike paths. You know, I mean, I don't see that there's a problem with saying that now, so that goes in our minutes.
I would accept.
It would help reinforce and remind us all that we have it there and we'd like it there.
I could just jump in, have those be anticipated future agenda items for January, because I don't know what the Bill and Frank show may have as far as items that need to come to you in January that will, well, he'll have already packed the agenda, but those will be put on as future.
It's just informational, Madam Chair. Do you know what the schedule is on filling slots?
On who?
That's in January also, first.
Well, what the City Council does their appointments in January, and new members would take seats.
Expect to go on for a bit that don't have a deadline might be best started in February for that reason.
Okay. Is everybody okay for adjournment?
No, wait just a moment, please.
Go ahead, Roger.
We do have another future agenda item that for the future, not for January, December, January, but just somewhere down in the future. There's a fascinating program, if I may take a moment, introduced by a previous Nobel Prize winner, and I'm embarrassed I can't remember her name, the woman from Africa.
Wangari Maathai?
Thank you, yes. Trying to introduce a program worldwide. There are 6 billion people on the planet, and it is her fervent desire to have 1/6 of the population plant a tree, which would mean 1 billion trees. And it's a program that I believe through the United Nations that she's trying to encourage. And I was wondering if this board would be interested in having a discussion on it and getting the city of Morro Bay involved.
Certainly.
Merely a question, merely a suggestion.
Is it a fabulous idea?
Do you have some material?
At the moment, no, but if the board would be willing to discuss it in the future, I would make sure that we did have materials and I would get them to you.
Okay. I am writing it down with the question mark, January, if things aren't backed up
right,
or staff things.
Yes.
And,
does that need to be a motion?
That would be
or
appreciated.
Second that.
We don't normally have a formal motion for agenda items.
Okay.
Just a consensus, I believe.
Yeah. The consensus.
If we're all in favor.
We attend the council meetings pretty regularly, so please keep us known. And email always works.
Very good. I'll look into it.
Was there a motion for adjournment?
So moved.
Second.
A second? All right. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
At 8:05.